This is a WSMI podcast from the Tally Broadcasting Station.
FM 106, 10 after 2, standing by. Not only have we got Sean here, of course, but also standing by is our latest author, our good friend Luke Eplin. Luke, good afternoon. Thanks for joining our show today.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things that we're most interested in, of course, is how this book became to be written. And Sean here has got a bunch of questions, too. So hopefully you got a few minutes that you can hang out with us and talk a little bit about this very exciting process here.
Yeah, I do. The book was the book is about the Cleveland Indians in the 1940s. They were the second Major League baseball team to become integrated. And I'm from Litchfield, Illinois, so there, I have no connection to Cleveland. But my grandfather was a big St. Louis Browns fan. There were two baseball teams in St. Louis until 1953. There was the Cardinals and the St. Louis Browns. And the St. Louis Browns, their last owner was a guy named Bill Veeck, who was a showman, who was perhaps most famous for bringing a little person named Eddie Goodell to the plate. But he owned the Cleveland Indians in the 1940s. And I wanted to write about the Browns because of my grandfather's connection, but then I really became interested in the sort of integration angle, and so that's why I started writing about Cleveland.
Well, I'll tell you, that is a fascinating backdrop. And the St. Louis Browns and Eddie Goodell, you think of Bill Veeck, and you think of the P.T. Barnum-like promoter and disco demolition night on Chicago's South Side, but his involvement with the Cleveland Indians seems to be understated. And what a great success story that is, especially when you think of 70 years plus with no championship. This is a guy who really was a trailblazer. I mean, I think sometimes we think of him as this carnivalistic kind of character, but he really was a bold man who took on the establishment in the time that you didn't take on the establishment in baseball or anywhere else. It had to take guts to really start that integration ball rolling. And you had a man of principle in Branch Rickey in Brooklyn, of course, the former Cardinal personnel guru who really changed the game. But sounds like Bill Veeck didn't get enough credit for bringing Larry Doby into the fold.
That's exactly right. Nowadays, whenever people think about Bill Veeck, they think about the things that you mentioned. The fact that he brought a little person to the plate, that he innovated such things like exploding scoreboards, these sort of wild promotions he would do. He would give away, like, livestock before games. He would have fans manage from the stands, all these sorts of things like this. And so now we sort of think of him as just kind of a showman. But I think that his most lasting legacy was the fact that he integrated the American League. And it wasn't like he integrated the American League years after the Brooklyn Dodgers brought up Jackie Robinson. He integrated the American League 11 weeks after Jackie Robinson's debut in Major League Baseball. So Larry Doby came in July of 1947 onto the Indians. And so Bill Veeck was very much a pioneer, just as much as Branch Rickey was in terms of integration. And it really was because Veeck integrated the Indians with Larry Doby and then Satchel Paige in 1948 that the Indians were finally able to win the World Series championship in 1948. So yeah, he was a trailblazer in ways that now unfortunately have been a little bit lost.
And do you think because of the focus on Robinson that maybe he had more protection, so to speak, more planning was involved in making sure he got from point A to point B okay than Doby, who certainly maybe had the American League president focused on him, but not what we saw off in Brooklyn?
Yeah, so Larry Doby and Jackie Robinson differed in some very key respects. Jackie Robinson was signed by the Dodgers in October of 1945. He then spent an entire year in the Brooklyn Dodgers minor league system. on the Montreal Royals. And then he did two spring trainings with the Dodgers before he finally made the team in April of 1947. So he had a sort of 18-month buildup to sort of acclimate himself to the realities of an all-white clubhouse and the sort of racism that he was going to face and things like that. Larry Doby, by contrast, found out that the Indians had signed him on July 2nd, 1947. He then had 2 days before he had to report to the club. He played on the Newark Eagles of the Negro Leagues. He played on July 4th, 1947, in a doubleheader, caught a train in Newark to Chicago, where the Indians were playing the White Sox, and suited up for the Indians the next day. In other words, he literally traveled overnight from the Negro Leagues to the Major Leagues. It was a shock to his system. He faced a chilly clubhouse with the Indians. There were several players on the team that were skeptical of integration, and he was so nervous and unprepared for being in the Major Leagues that he said that during the first 10 games he played, his teeth were chattering uncontrollably every time he came up to the plate. He was also 5 years younger than Jackie Robinson, so it was a much different road than Robinson had traveled. Certainly they faced the same degree of racism and segregated accommodations and things like this that they had to deal with, but Doby was just thrown into the fire.
Now, the one thing that's unique, I know in no time, Jackie had some teammates of color. When you look at Roy Campanella, and certainly that had to help as time wore on. In Cleveland, I guess in that magical season, the legendary Satchel Paige was in the mix. Did that make it easier? What was the dynamic there?
Well, Larry Doby came up in July 1947, and then he spent a year as the lone black player on the Indians. And one of the things that he talked about often to sports writers at the time, especially black sports writers, was the loneliness that he faced. At that time, baseball players roomed with each other, and then they usually sort of went out at night when they're in other cities. Doby was often in segregated accommodations and could not go out at night with his teammates, so he was alone most of the time, really wanting some other black teammate to share the burden, to talk with, to confide in, things like that. When Satchel Paige came in July of 1948, he's 17 years older than Larry Doby. He's already a legend. He had come up through the Negro Leagues in the 1920s and built himself up into somebody whose pitching lore sort of crossed racial lines. He was known not only by black fans, but by white fans. He was one of the few sort of black stars at that time that white mainstream press was writing about. And so he was on a much different level than Doby. He was much older than Doby. And so they, in fact, did not quite get along. There was a generational gap that divided them, and they were not buddy-buddy at all. So even though I think that Doby certainly appreciated having another black teammate, it wasn't the one that Doby was hoping for.
This is a Cleveland clubhouse. I imagine they had some strong personalities. It was not a... you weren't bringing into a team with a bunch of rookies. I mean, when you think of larger-than-life figure, I have to think of Bob Feller, a guy who walks into World War II, not just for a year, but for an extended period, comes back, and still has it in a big way.
Yeah, Bob Feller was a prodigy in his day. His story would have been known to any baseball fan at that time. He was from a farm in central Iowa. His dad sensed an incredible ability in his son from an early age, so he cleared off a portion of his pasture and built Bob Feller a baseball field right there. It was essentially the Field of Dreams. Feller, at age 17, made it onto the Indians roster. He was a junior in high school. In his very first start ever in the Major Leagues, he tied the American League record in strikeouts. It's an incredible story. He became a sensation. He was so popular that Bob Feller's high school graduation was broadcast live on the radio from coast to coast. And so one of the things that Feller would do in the off season was barnstorm. This is whenever white players, after the season was over, would get together, go across the sort of country in towns and cities that did not have major league teams, and play baseball, because there was no television at that time. So these other fans didn't get a chance to see these players, and they often played against teams made up of black players. So Bob Feller and Satchel Paige faced each other dozens of times on the barnstorming trail. They became sort of a rivalry of sorts amongst them. And so the fact that Feller and Paige then became teammates on the Indians is really one of the most incredible coincidences in baseball. So, yeah, Feller was definitely in his prime at this time.
I know sometimes it's different when you have, a different we've seen some clubhouse issues, I guess, with teams in the 80s, 90s, and beyond, whether it's, players coming from, south of the border, or sometimes we haven't really heard it as much lately because we've heard about the almost demise of the black players at times as they've kind of walked away from baseball. But clubhouse issues have popped up here and there. I have to think 1948, how tough was it for them to adjust to play as one?
Well, there were a lot of factors that had to come into play here. Larry Doby, whenever he broke in 1947, in his second game with the Indians, Lou Boudreau, who was the Indians' manager at the time, he was also a superstar shortstop, had Doby play first base. The first baseman on the Indians at that time was a guy named Eddie Robinson, and he was a young player who'd just gotten out of the war. He had been in the minor leagues. He was struggling to stay in the majors. His average was around 220-something. So he was really kind of, struggling to stay there. And whenever a black player came on the team and suddenly was taking playing time away from him, Eddie Robinson quit the team on the spot and said, "I just don't even want to play then if that's going to happen." It didn't last long. He eventually rejoined the Indians. But that was the sort of thing that Larry Doby would have to deal with. These were sorts of players that did not want black players to take their playing time, and then there were players from the South who just simply did not want to play on the same team as black players. And then, of course, Doby had to face sort of abuse from the fans, and sometimes whenever he would come to the stadium, the security guards wouldn't let him in because they didn't believe he was part of the team. All of these sorts of things added up.
Obviously were very much the norm in 1947, 1948. But think about what it would be like today. One thing that he didn't have to deal with was paparazzi and the type of reporter that you see on TMZ or something like that that was following him around waiting for him to slip up on something. And you also didn't have cell phones with cameras that every possible move was basically recorded, just looking to find a reason to put him in a bad stead with not only his teammates, his team, but also the public. So in that regard, it was easier. But on the other hand, I can see where the loneliness would have been the overriding issue.
Yeah, Larry Doby talked about during his time in the Negro League when he was on the Newark Eagles, if you had a bad day, if you made some errors, if you struck out, if you blew the game or something like that, you could go back to the hotel, your teammates would be there, you could talk to them, you could sort of shake it off in a sense. They could get your mind off of it, you could relax a little bit, or they could sort of talk you through some of the things that went wrong. But then, now when he's on the Indians and something happens, he's going back to an empty hotel room, and he's by himself. And there's not a lot of people, besides Jackie Robinson, who can really understand what he's going through. And so it is a loneliness that I think was pretty hard for him to communicate. In his first week or so with the Indians, he loses 10 pounds. He is just so stressed and nervous by everything that is happening around him. And it's not something that his white teammates can really relate to, or at that time even sort of recognize what he was going through. And so it's an isolation. I think Doby said that really the only good time for him in that sort of first year was whenever he was on the field, because then he was around people, he was part of the team and all that, but then he'd go off one way and he'd suddenly be separate. So it's a sort of alienation that I think is hard to grasp.
When Lou Boudreau was, of course, the playing manager, he was two things. He obviously was ingrained to his players, but as the manager, he was also the boss of his players. How did Larry Doby get along with the playing manager, the manager side versus the player side?
I think Lou Boudreau was put in a very tough box. When Bill Veeck bought the team in 1946, the Cleveland Indians, that is, Lou Boudreau had been the manager since 1942. He became the manager of the Indians at only 24 years old. He was not known to be a great tactician. He was somebody who, let's say, managed from his gut. Like, he would sort of go by what his hunches or what his gut told him. Veeck was interested in a manager that had more of a sort of strategy, statistical mind to him. And so Veeck made it known that he would prefer that Lou Boudreau just go back to being shortstop and they get another manager. Boudreau, however, told Veeck that if he was fired as manager, you'd also have to fire me as shortstop because I will not play on the Indians if I'm not the manager. And so Veeck was trying to unload Boudreau for years. He was trying to get rid of him so he could get a different manager, and Boudreau was constantly trying to show Veeck that I'm a good manager and I can be here. You put integration on top of that, and that is another complicating issue that Boudreau has to worry about in addition to worrying about his job safety. And so with integration, Boudreau had to worry not only about sort of making sure that Larry Doby had what he needed, could sort of get a good trial to figure out if he was major league material, but he had to balance the interests of the white players that didn't really want Doby there in the first place. And so in 1947, when Larry Doby comes up, Boudreau plays him pretty regularly in the first week or so, and then whenever a bunch of white players kind of slightly revolted, Doby didn't get hardly any at-bats after that. He only came up to bat around 30-something times that first year, and I think Boudreau was kind of recognizing that if he played Doby a little bit more and sat some of the white players, there could be a revolt on his hands. And so Doby at that time was not the biggest fan of Lou Boudreau, and it was a tough balancing act for him to do.
Cleveland, I know in 1947-48 was a different place. Long before the lake caught fire, it was such a vibrant American city, and before the interstate system, I'm sure the Great Lakes were even more important, moving products and materials. A very, very vibrant place at that time, very alive. Yeah. And was it a tougher environment than what Jackie Robinson saw in New York?
That was what Bill Veeck was worried about. He really thought that Jackie Robinson was the right person in the right place. He saw Brooklyn, which has a multicultural sort of place. It's a sort of swirl of cultures and ethnicities that are there. And he thought that that was the right borough to integrate in, that there would be enough sort of fans that are used to the diversity that they would accept Jackie Robinson. He was more worried about Cleveland. He thought that Cleveland was perhaps a more, let's say, traditionalist place. But I think that he was not quite right about that. But in 1946, the Cleveland Browns, the football team, had already integrated. They had two black players on the team. They won the championship that year and set attendance records. The Cleveland had a Negro League team that was very well attended, won the Negro League World Series in 1945. And by that point, there had been enough black residents that had come up from the South that Cleveland had a thriving black community that was really sort of making inroads in politics and jobs and other sorts of things. So Cleveland, too, was a really was a very multi-ethnic place. And sure enough, whenever Veeck integrates in 47, the Indians shatter the major league attendance mark in 1948. So it surely did not turn off fans to such an extent that they didn't show up.
Luke Eplin is our guest. Luke is the author of a brand new book highlighting the 1948 Cleveland Indians, including the introduction of Larry Doby as the first black player in the American League. Also, Satchel Paige coming along after that. Luke, what's the name of the book, and how does a person go about getting it? Because it sounds like a fascinating read.
Oh, thank you. The book is called Our Team, the epic story of four men and the World Series that changed baseball. It is on sale today, so if you order it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever, you'll be able to get it right away. If you go to AstoriaBookshop.com, that is my local neighborhood bookstore, and if you order online from there, you can get a signed copy.
Oh, that sounds awesome. One question I have for you. You've uncovered a lot of stuff that wasn't necessarily part of the overall public knowledge, either then or now, because you've told me things that I had no idea about, and I thought I was a pretty good historian of baseball. I know Sean the same way. What were some of the sources that you had to basically uncover to get the deep down stories that you got?
Yeah. Since this story takes place nearly 75 years ago, unfortunately, many of the participants in the book have since passed away. There's only one member of the 1948 Indians who's still alive, and that is Eddie Robinson. He just turned 100 years old, lives in Texas, and it still has an excellent memory. I went down and spent a weekend with him. He gave me some great firsthand details of the team, including his own remembrances of when Larry Doby came and met with the joined the Cleveland Indians. But for the most part, I did have to rely on newspaper sources, magazine sources, and some oral histories with the players. So I spent a lot of time. I've moved to Cleveland for a while, spent a lot of time in the microfilm, going through day by day, trying to uncover things.
It's amazing.
Boy, I look at baseball, what an important instrument in those times. Music really wasn't something that was set to change the world. Radio was very conservative. You weren't going to get it done at the ballot box. It seemed like the diamond was the one place you could change America, from what I can tell. Is that pretty much your conclusion?
Yeah, so there's a good example of this in the book, and I don't want to spoil anything, but the Indians make it to the World Series in 1948. It's the first time that they've been to the World Series in 28 years, since 1920, and they really get there because of the extraordinary play of Larry Doby and Satchel Paige. In other words, it's only because the Indians integrated that they were able to finally get over the hump, beat teams like the Yankees and the Red Sox, and make it to the World Series. In Game 4 of the World Series, Larry Doby hits a home run off of Johnny Sain, who was a pitcher for the Boston Braves, the team the Indians faced that year. It turns out to be the winning run of the game. The Indians win 2-1, just barely. The Indians' starting pitcher was a guy named Steve Gromek. He was a Polish-American from Detroit. After the game, he finds Doby in the clubhouse and gives him this gigantic hug. Their faces are pressed together, their eyes are shut in ecstasy, and it's just this great sort of spontaneous moment of celebration between a white man and a black man, and photographers captured that moment, and the picture ran on the front pages of newspapers the next day, and you really just didn't see an image like that in 1948, particularly on the front pages of newspapers, of sort of this joyous, spontaneous celebration between men of two different races. The black newspapers at the time really, really said things like, an image like this can sort of wipe away racism in the mind of younger people, point a way forward. So baseball was a place where you could find images and scenes like that.
Wow, just an incredible story. And I look at all of these great stories about baseball, and it was such a dominant force in the lives of Americans at that time. But I especially like to see the deeper look at Bob Feller, because one of the complaints I have, we talk about it quite a bit here, is that people make quick judgments in national media now, and there are layers to things. And you talk about Bob Feller and the times. I know a lot of people have just kind of all of a sudden just taken a big broad brush and said he was a racist, and this certainly shows that Bob Feller was is not a simplistic individual at all.
No, in fact, there are many different layers to Bob Feller, and I think that if you do just paint him with that brush, you're doing him a disservice. Bob Feller, as I mentioned earlier, was somebody who barnstormed pretty much every offseason with black players. He sought them out to have good competition, but also to get more people into the stands, get something that the fans would want to see. And so he was not somebody who was shy about sharing the field with black players. He was also not someone who was shy about exposing himself to defeat. He faced off against Satchel Paige numerous times, and, you know, Paige would beat him often. And so he wasn't somebody who was afraid of something like that happening. And some of these barnstorming tours that Feller did were integral in showing sort of white fans, white writers, white executives, just how good black players were. They really elevated the status of certain players, including Satchel Paige, that helped him get into the league. Feller, unfortunately, would say things when asked about black players, about whether they had the sort of abilities to get into the majors. He would often say no, that he didn't think that they combined the qualities necessary to be a major leaguer. And I think it's because, I mean, what I kind of go into in the book is that he has this incredible origin story where he goes from the farm to the majors basically overnight, and it's just this extraordinary leap. And he kind of does it through, you know, extreme hard work, self-reliance, rugged individualism, all these things that we think about that are these sort of classic, sort of white American values. And so he sort of is looking at black players through that prism and saying to himself that maybe if they're not in the majors, it's because they haven't worked hard enough. They haven't sort of pulled themselves up or whatever. He's not necessarily seeing the structural and systemic barriers and prejudices that are before them. So in other words, he's a little bit blind to these sorts of things. And in that way, he was a complicated figure. But yeah, painting with a broad brush, I think, would be a big disservice to Feller.
Luke, your book, I'm sorry, Sean, can I ask one thing real quick? Luke, your book comes out today. The advance sales have been absolutely terrific. This is a vital story that needs to be told, I think, especially today with some of the social issues we're dealing with around the country. But my question is, even though this book just comes out today and I know it'll do well, I gotta believe there are more stories that you want to tell in the future. Are you working on another book or two idea now as we speak?
I hope to. Unfortunately, with the way that the pandemic has played out here, a lot of the libraries and things like that have been either closed or restricted. And I really came across this book just going to the library on the weekends, requesting sort of archival material, leafing through things. And I was looking at the sporting news from 1946 to 1948, and I kept seeing four names come up: Bob Feller, Larry Doby, Bill Veeck, Satchel Paige. And I was noticing how these names sort of complemented each other, were in tension with each other, sort of told different facets of the integration story. And that's how I really came across this. Unfortunately, in the pandemic, I just haven't been able to get to the library much. So I'm working on something, but it's not quite there yet for me to talk about.
Okay.
Well, before you wrote for these national publications, put out books, what have you, going back to your youth here in mid-Illinois, was there anyone that lit the pilot light for you as a writer, a teacher that noticed your talent, what have you, that stood out?
In Illinois, I grew up in Litchfield. My father's Jerome Eplin. He's a huge baseball fan. He had a big shelf full of baseball books that I devoured as a kid. So that was a huge help. When I was in high school, I was a huge lover of reading, but I never thought about the writing aspect, and so it wasn't a goal of mine when I was in Litchfield. I had several teachers at Litchfield High School that were integral to my development. I'm thinking particularly of Coach Dan Newkirk, who is the coach of the track team there. I was a big track guy when I was in high school. But yeah, I didn't really start writing until I went to college.
Is there anything that stood out in the book that maybe you, obviously, if you have an editor, somebody says, I wish you could have done this, or you'd spent too much time on that. Is there anything that you would have liked to have expanded even further if you had time, or you would have had the space to do, or
yeah,
are you really satisfied?
No, the book is about 300 pages of text, along with lots of notes and stuff. It was originally twice that long. It was quite a monster whenever I first wrote it, and there were three sort of areas that we had to trim down, and it was very painful for me to do so. I was really fascinated by the war service of these individuals. Larry Doby, Bob Feller, and Bill Veeck all served in the South Pacific during the war, and I went on the USS Alabama, which is stationed in Mobile, Alabama. It's now a floating museum, and they have Bob Feller's bunk where he served on the USS Alabama, roped off, and you can sort of go there and talk to people that know all this knowledge. So I had an entire chapter on Feller in World War II. I had an entire chapter on Doby and on Veeck. We had to just really kind of trim that down. And then I had a lot about Larry Doby and the Negro Leagues. He played on the Newark Eagles. The co-owner of that team was a woman named Etha Manley, who is now in the Baseball Hall of Fame. She, I think, is one of the most fascinating figures in baseball history. She was a woman in the Gentlemen's Club of Baseball. There were not very many women executives at that time, and she was a tough, fierce woman who really fought for her team and her ball club. I could have written an entire book about her, but we had to cut a lot of the stuff.
Well, there might be four or five more books, you know, right there.
I could just keep writing books about this era. I mean, this era is so rich because, as you say, you not only have integration and the war, but the country is just baseball mad. Whenever these servicemen come back from the war, they're looking to baseball to establish normalcy, to make them feel at home. They're sort of going to stadiums in numbers that baseball had never seen before. It's like baseball is what they're coming back to. And so it's so central to the culture at this time.
I thought I'd just get away from the book for a moment. I read a fascinating piece you had on Stan Musial. The fact that he was so accommodating to people, that he was so kind and really helpful to the later stages of integration. Well, even the initial ones when you talk about encountering Jackie, what have you. But that sense of just being personable, maybe hurt him in the long run. I guess the standoffishness of a DiMaggio or Ted Williams almost added to their mystique.
Yeah, so I wrote that for The Atlantic after Stan Musial died. And it's just that we kind of remember Stan Musial as sort of baseball's perfect knight. And I think that whenever you describe someone A as perfect and B as a knight, you're putting them up on such a pedestal that you're erasing their humanity in a respect. It's not easy for someone to relate to somebody who is a perfect knight. At that time, Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams, and I think definitely Bob Feller too, were the other big figures of that era, and they all had their flaws and their sort of human characteristics. Obviously, we know about DiMaggio's standoffishness. Williams was a hothead. He had quite a temper. And Bob Feller, as we had just discussed, was a rather complicated individual. Stan Musial, on the other hand, is just kind of known as a good old-fashioned guy, and I think there are so many different layers of Stan Musial that it does a disservice to just think of him as a perfect knight. He had so much more to him, but it gets sort of washed away with this idea of him being perfect.
I can understand that being the case. I mean, let's face it, when they leave him off the 100 greatest players of the century,
yeah,
you know.
Terrible.
Luke, it has been a pleasure having you with us today. I don't know if Sean has any more questions. I would imagine that you're excited to watch what happens as this book finally becomes available. I'm looking forward to ordering my copy, I don't mind telling you. And I look forward to reading it more than I look forward to ordering it, because I think the read is going to be fabulous. So you want to mention one more time again how to get it, what it costs, if you want to, and let us know again.
Sure. The book is called Our Team, The Epic Story of Four Men in the World Series that Changed Baseball. It's on sale today, so you'll be able to get it in bookstores, on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, places like this. Anybody that likes baseball, it is about the Cleveland Indians, but I think it tells a much larger story, so I think even Cardinals or Cubs fans should be into it.
What did you say was your original or your neighborhood bookstore, you said, where you could get an autographed copy?
Yes, that is Astoria Bookshop. So if you go to AstoriaBookshop.com, that's all one word, Astoria Bookshop, I will be signing any copy that is ordered through that store online.
Well, that sounds great. Sean, anything else you want to add before we let Luke go?
I was just going to say I struck out. I figured Luke was named after Old Aches and Pains, Luke Appling, but close to no cigar.
I was named after Luke Skywalker. Yeah, so that's the truth.
Yeah, he broke out of the Tatooine minors there,
yeah.
And out of the Class A rookie league at Mos Eisley.
That's right.
Luke, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today. We really enjoyed the visit. We wish you great, great success with the book.
Thank you so much.